Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Julianne Boyd, co-founder of the Barrington Stage Company, BSC, located in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. Julianne has directed many productions, including two world premieres by Marc St. Germain, Dr. Ruth, All the Way, which has played in New York City. At Barrington Stage, she has directed All My Sons, The Crucible, Sweeney Todd, Streetcar Named Desire, West Side Story, Follies, the world premiere, musical The Game, based on Les Liaisons Dangereuses, Cyrano de Bergerac, and The Importance of Being Earnest. In 1979, she directed BSC's smash hit production of Cabaret, which won 6 Boston Critic Awards and transferred to the Hasty Pudding Theater in Cambridge for an extended run. In 1978, Ms. Boyd conceived and directed the musical Yubi, a show based on Shuffle Along, the first black musical, 1919 on Broadway, with music by Yubi Blake. Yubi starred Gregory and Maurice Hines and garnered 3 Tony nominations. In 1980, Citicorp honored her with an Outstanding Young Entrepreneur Award for reintroducing Yubi Blake's music to the public. Ms. Boyd has worked extensively in regional theaters, where her directorial credits include As You Like It, Tea at the Old Globe Theater, Sweet and Hot, The Songs of Harold Arlen at the McCarter Theater, La Jolla Playhouse, and the Coconut Grove Playhouse, and The Country Wife at Syracuse Stage. Her production of Melina Hassou, Houston's Tea at the Odyssey Theater in Los Angeles, won 3 Dramalogue Awards, including a special award for ensemble acting. In 2001, Julie Boyd created the Playwright Mentoring Project, BSC's Youth at Risk program that won the prestigious Coming Up Taller Award in 2007. This award, given by the President's Committee on the Arts and the Humanities, is the nation's highest honor for after-school and out-of-school programming. Julianne Boyd holds a PhD in theater history from the CUNY Graduate Center, where her area of concentration, I love this, was classical Japanese theater. Ms. Boyd and her husband Norman have 3 grown children, Sarah, Ned, and Emily. Welcome, Julianne Boyd.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you very much.
Okay. Where were you born?
I was born in Easton, Pennsylvania. Have you ever been there, Alan?
I'm sure I have. What do they do?
Claim to fame is Binney and Smith Crayola crayons.
No kidding.
Yeah.
No,
yeah,
I've eaten a lot of Crayola crayons in my life, as all children have.
Yeah, that's it, though. I mean, it's sort of on the way to Allentown, Bethlehem, Reading, and, you know, out to Harrisburg.
Steel stuff.
Yeah. Bethlehem Steel's just, you know, one town away.
And what did your dad do?
My father was a principal of a junior high school, and my mom was a teacher.
So when did you get bit?
By theater?
Yeah.
I think probably in 6th grade, because we lived in the country, like farmland type, and I went to this little country school, and I think I was the best reader in 6th grade, so they asked me to play the flag in the school play.
Yeah, I thought,
oh, this is fun. Yeah. Oh, this is fun. You get up and you talk, and I could memorize, you know. So.
Well, memory is so important, isn't it?
Well, I think at that age particularly.
I think at any age.
Well, I can do it. As we get older, I think it's more and more important, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, and I was sort of bitten by it, but I was acting in junior high school and high school and college. But by the time I got to college, I wanted to direct. But there were no women directors. This is in the 60s. There were no women directors, really. There were a couple like Eva LaGallien and a few of these very famous actresses who became directors, but not because they were directors. They were actresses who became directors. And then I wanted to become a director. And I remember I was married. I had 2 kids by then. I was in my late 20s and working on my PhD in theater.
Well, let's stay there for a minute because I'm interested in that. You married Norman the dentist, who
yes.
is a wonderful, wonderful man who
Thank
I love.
Thank you, Alan.
And how did that happen? How did you get together with a dentist as a dramatist yourself?
Well, I was 18 when I met him, and he was 21.
That's an older man.
I was going for an older man then. And he was singing in the Glee Club at my college. He went to Lafayette College. I was at Beaver College, an all-girls school in Philly, outside of Philly. Yeah. Anyhow, so we met, and we got married right after college, which is what one did in the 60s, of course, unless you were kind of wild. And I was not a wild one then. I really did everything by the books. And I came from a strong Italian Catholic background. You got married, because if you didn't get married, you were going home to live.
And what was he?
What do you mean, what was he? Italian?
He's
at WASP with a capital W. He's German, Scottish, English. Although recently, Alan, this has nothing to do with Barrington Stage. I will tell you that he had his ancestry checked on Ancestry.com, and they found that he was 48% Tuscan. So he now thinks he's Italian.
So he has some Italian.
Yes,
in him.
And I think that's pretty funny because looking at Norman, it's really, really far back.
So you married Norman, and he was starting a practice.
He was still in dental school.
He's still in dental school.
Yeah.
Did he work on your teeth?
His father did. He comes from a long line of dentists.
His father worked on your teeth.
His father, his grandfather, a dentist. His brother's a dentist.
Wasn't that a little intimate, to be?
His father? No, he was a great dentist. I mean, do you know the dentistry I had in Easton, Pennsylvania? Do you know what that was like? I mean, I was thrilled to go to a New York dentist and have like real dentistry, real dental work done.
Did you have to pay?
Of course not. Uh-huh. We were probably engaged at that point. He probably wouldn't have worked on my teeth unless we were engaged,
My Uncle Arthur worked on my teeth, and there's nothing to write home about. So my question to you is, has that marriage to Norman helped you in your life?
Yes, I think it has, because I think you can't have a career in theater where you make no money. I mean, for many, many years, I've made no money. In fact, the first money I made in theater, I started professional theater, I would say, around 1970, and the first penny I made was in 1978 or 79 when I had Yubi go to Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're many, many years in starting Barrington Stage Company. I mean, for many, many years, I made nothing or very, very little. So being able to have a husband who makes a living helps you have a family. I wanted a family. He wanted a family. So in our instance, we had our children first, and then I really had my career took off. Nowadays, women, I think, have their careers out of school. They go right away. When they're 35 or 40, they go, I want to have a child. And so it allowed me to have a family when I was young and really probably allowed me to start and continue with Barrington Stage Company. It's not that I couldn't have done it, but I think it would have been much, much more difficult, allowed me to concentrate on the creative aspects of everything that we did or do.
So my daughter fits into the paradigm you just announced. She waited until she was 36 years old to have a child, but she's tenured. She's at a prestigious college. What, in fact, did you find having a child, because I'm so interested in this now, or children, did to your career?
Well, you see, I really have two families with the same husband. As you know, my children are very far apart. My oldest daughter, my youngest daughter, 15 years apart. And I have a son in between. So I reared children for a long time. I think what it did in theater is it made me more understanding and it made me more patient. And so if an actor was going off because the actor was upset or a producer was calling me at 2 a.m, I knew that I couldn't do anything at 2 a.m. with that producer. And I would say, you know what? I mean, it just made me, I think, rather calmer in some extraordinary circumstances. And I think the way I talk to actors is probably different from the way men talk to actors. I think I'm a little more understanding. At the theater company, they call me Mama Jewel because I'm mother to the world. I'm mother to everyone. Somebody has a problem. I want to help them. And so I think at an early age, I learned that. That doesn't mean that people don't have it at an early age. Theater is a very difficult career, and people really go so focused they forget the real world. It allowed me to have the real world, enter my world. And my husband loves it. He's very, very excited. He has a lot of people in his practice a lot of theater people. He's in New York. And so he's used to the people in the arts, and he certainly is, having been married to me for 48 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you mentioned a word which I've always been confused about a little bit, but I think I understand it. I just want to ask you about it. You said the call to the producer. The producer and the director, of course, is you. I mean, you make these things happen, but and you've been a producer too, of course. But a producer is somebody who comes up with the money, isn't it?
In the commercial theater, there's the producer who comes up with the money, comes up with the capitalization of the project, and then the director works with that producer. Because the producer holds the strings to the money, money bag, so to speak, the director is always beholden to someone. And in this case, it's the producer. At Barrington Stage, I'm the artistic director, which is comparable to being a producer, but I also answer to a board. A commercial producer only answers to his investors. I answer to my board.
Theoretically, you answer your board, but I've been close to this whole thing.
Answer to my board.
Well, no, you answer to your board, but your board also has tremendous respect for you, and you're the leader.
Yes. I think what the board does...
You don't
does,
have a board member who's going to pound on the table and say, Julie, this is what I want you to do this year.
Well, not artistically. In other words, no one would tell an artistic director, or shouldn't, what plays we should produce, because the artistic director has to have the authority in that area. And if the board doesn't like what play you're putting on, then they can get rid of you. And they can suggest you ought to go in a different direction, or maybe we have to look in it somewhere else. I mean, my board has never said that. I think what the board's job is you have a board, don't you? They create policy and they help you raise money and they advise you. I have wonderfully wise people on the board and expertise that I don't have. So, I mean, we have a CPA who's like kind of brilliant on our board. We have people who've been on other boards who know how to get things done. And I think that's important. So I do listen to my board. And the more we go along, you know, you really develop a board that becomes a unit. And I think that's the important
thing. That's true. Yeah. Except I want to answer your question.
Okay. What question did I ask?
You said you have a board, don't you? And don't
yes.
they? And the answer is no in both cases.
But you don't have a board.
No, I have a wonderful board. I have a wonderful board, and they stop me from stepping into mud every once in a while, and they'll say, that's not a good idea, or we should talk about that.
Yeah.
But they have never, ever been the major party for raising the money for WAMC.
Oh.
You see, that's sort of false.
That's different. I mean, I'm active in raising money,
yeah.
but I couldn't do, not only do
no,
you select
different.
The, yeah, you know what I mean?
It's
you
different.
Cast them, and then I'm an artistic director who also directs. Some artistic directors don't direct.
Right.
But being in the rehearsal room in the summer is very, and in the fall, is very difficult because you have all the other work to do as an artistic director, and then you direct
as
well.
I've tried to get you on the phone sometimes. Not always that easy. Okay.
Email me. Yes.
Okay. So the producer, when you were in that other life, the Broadway sort of life and the other life, the producer becomes the money guy or money woman. Are these relationships ever contentious?
They can be. I think they are sometimes. I mean, because the producer also has investors, big investors on their back, you know, people who've given them a lot of money. I'm not as familiar with that world. I didn't have problems when I was like when I directed UB on Broadway. I think the only thing the producer wanted me to do, he wanted me to add a non-UB Blake song because he thought UB Blake songs, we're talking about UB, you know, we needed a more popular song. And I said, well, what do you mean? I mean, we just got the rights to UB Blake's music and I can't add another. And he was sort of like a little, you know, not dense, or he was a little bit more commercial than I was. And he literally suggested, Alan, why didn't we add something like, I still remember this, Mac the Knife or Life is Just a Bowl of Cherries.
And you
to
said
UB.
No.
Well, we had already gotten rave reviews in Philly. That's where we started. We were coming into New York, and he wanted to make sure it was a big New York hit.
Yeah, he also probably wanted to have some imprint on the show. So,
well,
so
I, who knows?
So like, you said no?
I said no, because I had a contract with UB saying I would only use UB Blake music. Thank God I had a contract
and
with UB.
And what happened
Blake.
When you said no to him?
He was fine.
He's fine.
He was fine. You push. You can't win. You don't win, and you pull back.
Okay, you're a very strong woman. I would not want to be at odds with you.
Alan, you're just such a pussycat.
Yes, I am. Okay, so that brings us to the next set of questions. You started Barrington Stage. You started in a high school, Mount Everett High School in Sheffield, Massachusetts, and it was a high school auditorium. That's what it was.
It was a high school auditorium. You know, we tried, you know, it's called Barrington Stage because we wanted to be in Great Barrington.
Yeah.
And when Susan Sperber and I were looking around, we said, oh, no problem, Great Barrington. We're going to find a place in Great Barrington. We're looking for 100, a space that we could seat 100 people and we could build a little stage. Well, we couldn't find anything. We looked in garages and this and that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then someone said, you ought to go down to Mount Everett High School because the Consolati Performing Arts Center, it's a new building. And it's a great, great theater space. Well, what people think is a great theater space.
No.
Oh, my. You've been there, Alan.
Not many times.
And so it has 26 rows. It's 500 seats.
Looks like an auditorium. You pledge
auditorium.
Allegiance to the flag.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the theater where we are now in Pittsfield, it basically has 10 or 11 rows. And it's sort of, you know, a nice little sort of almost
yeah.
circular. And this had 26 rows. But we had Tom Consolati, who was a very, very special mentor of mine, superintendent of the schools at the time.
Great man.
He understood that a school had to be more than just a school. It had to be a community center. People pay taxes. They should be able to use it. And so we made a deal. I mean, you go in and it was like, oh, my God, after making all these deals with producers in New York, which took days and days, you know, an hour, he said, OK, this is what I want. I want the people in this community to be able to use this school in the summer. What do you have? And so I said, we have this theater company. We probably only need 100 seats. And he said, we allow kids 13 years and younger in for free. And I said, if accompanied by parents, I don't want this to be Camp Barrington.
Yeah, yeah.
And if the play is appropriate, he said, fine, here's the deal. It was a very low amount of money. And then what we had to do is turn the auditorium into a theater. And we had to bring in, they might have had 10 lighting instruments. They had no side lighting. It was just like coming straight down for the Pledge of Allegiance, you know. So we brought in two 100 instruments, 2 half-ton motors to build a frame to lift into. We attached it to the roof of this building.
Where'd you find the money for all this?
Well, what we did the first year is we raised money. We, believe it or not, had a budget of $247,000. It was. We didn't have it all at the beginning of the season. Actually, the first year, that was probably by the third year, we had the motors and the winches and all that stuff. I think the first couple of years, we just had some standing, what they call trees, metal trees that you put lighting instruments on. What we did is we sent around something at the very beginning saying, will you be a founding member for $1,000? And we had 5 or 6 board members, and I think together they contributed $40,000. We probably had close to $100,000 when we started Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill at the Mackinac Inn. And people thought they thought we were certifiable. They go, where are you going to that little place? And who's a tonic for? And it was, of course, a Billie Holiday show. And what better
Fabulous.
Place than, you needed to go to a slightly rundown place. It was a bar and grill. And we had people, after the first week, waiting in line to get in. And that was one of the ways that we really got an audience to begin with.
So who was on that first board?
There was 5 or 6 people. There was the woman who became our president, Marianne Quinson, who was president until this past year. She moved up to chairman. And now a wonderful board member, Marita Glott, is the president. Reed White, who became our treasurer, Liz and Lennox. Michelle Miller, who used to have the restaurant, The Boiler Room.
Sure.
Remember? Mark St. Germain, the playwright, from the very beginning.
Oh, was he? Right from the beginning?
Yes.
No kidding.
Right from the beginning. And John Kaiser, who's passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And we did it for, I think, maybe a year or two. And then we said, okay, this is mom and pop store. We got to enlarge. And then we added people after. I forget whether it was after the first or second year.
Tell us about Minky.
Minky is Marianne Quinson, our board president. And if you think I'm fearless and indomitable, you have to know there's two of us. And
Indeed. That's
why I think the theater has, part of its great success is that she's fearless. She's the one who suggested we move to Pittsfield. Because she read in the paper that a woman named Megan Wilden was becoming the director of cultural,
one of the best
affairs.
Things that ever happened to Pittsfield.
Yes. And so Minky said, they take theater seriously there. They take the art seriously. Let's look into it. And I said, oh, my God, Pittsfield, it's 45 minutes away. And she said, why don't you look and see in your zip codes of your patrons how many people live in that area, like a half hour from there, like go from Lee, Stockbridge, Lenox, up to Williamstown. And we realized that a third of our patrons lived in that corridor. So even though we were leaving Southern Berkshires and Connecticut, we would be picking people up. And then we sort of put a dot on the map. And from an hour around, we got Albany, Bennington, Northampton. And so we had a much larger group of people to draw from. And so she said, let's do it.
Now, what was Minky's background?
She is a therapist. Marriage therapist. And she was, before that, she was a ceramicist. She's an artist. And she and her husband had a house in Southfield in New York. They now moved to Pittsfield. And since we've been in Pittsfield, we've had a lot of people, I think, really helped Pittsfield.
And she comes from a very distinguished family, doesn't she?
Yes, she does. Her father was Andrew Goodman from Bergdorf Goodman's. And I think the main thing that Minky understands is what it means to support a theater and a vision. I mean, we started the Playwright Mentoring Project, our youth at risk programming. We were in Great Barrington at the time, and they were clamoring because, there's so many problem kids in Great Barrington on the streets. There aren't now, but there were at the time. And so we started this play. We were doing Suburbia, this play, but we didn't have any money to do it. We didn't have any place to do it. I would just meet with these kids a couple times a week in the local Unitarian church. And I went to Minky and I said, what do I do? I don't have the money. She said, you'll find the money. Just keep on going. And sometimes you just need to be told to keep on going.
Now, the she was so important to you
Yes. That
in the end, the great honoring of your main stage was named for you and for her.
Yeah, because we're really a team, really a team. And you can't do it alone. I mean, you just can't. You need someone to bounce ideas off of and somebody who's not afraid but yet understands that risk is only a risk if you look at the pros and cons. You can't say, oh, this is risky. Let's do it. Oh, that's dumb. But, if you say, I always say a risk is to me is something that makes common sense. For instance, moving to Pittsfield ended up being common sense.
No, let's talk about that. Okay, so Minky says, go to Pittsfield.
She said, look into it seriously.
Which means go to Pittsfield.
We tried to stay in Great Barrington, and that didn't work out. And so we had to move because our summer season in the school was down to 8 or 9 weeks. And we had so much we wanted to do, and we wanted to work outside the summer
season. Because the kids had to come to school and go to...
And you didn't get it till the third week in June, and we used to have it to the end of August, and then it was the third week in August. Then one year they made it middle August. We thought, we got to look around.
Yeah.
So we were looking around for about 3 years.
People got ticked off at you, didn't they, that you moved?
That we moved, yeah. Mm. They did.
Because people from the Southern Berkshires had bought into your concept. And then all of a sudden you're going to the big bad city, to Pittsfield, and they say, well, the hell with her, she's moving.
How dare she?
Yeah.
How dare she? And, you know, we spent 2 years looking all around Southern Berkshire County. We called everyone we could. Lots of people didn't return our calls. And we could not find a place. And we also, being in Sheffield, it wasn't a community as such. You know, people are very separate. In Pittsfield, you know exactly when the city council meeting is. You know exactly when meetings are. You know where to go. I always say we were looking for a piece of glass on a Saturday night to replace in a set. There was nothing in Sheffield, nothing in the whole South County. Sure. We had to go to Pittsfield to get this. And it was like we were constantly going to Pittsfield to get what we needed. And so it ended up being wonderful. And what happened was we did lose those people the first year. In 2006 was our first season. We were 11 years in Sheffield. Then we moved. 2006 was our first season. The end of the year, we started with Ring Round the Moon. And, oh, I'm not coming up to that. And they really thought the city was unsafe, which is ridiculous. Because the more people we have there, the safer it will be. We now have 52,000 patrons that come in every year. So that's like a lot of people, which really equates to bringing into town $4.5 million worth of business because of the gas, because of the hotels, because of the restaurants and so forth. So they didn't come back. You know when they came back?
When?
West Side Story. Oh. Our second year, we did a big musical.
Appropriate.
Yeah. Well, not only is it appropriate, but I had to do a show that they wanted to see and that they would travel for.
Oh,
even though they traveled to Tanglewood, and Pittsfield's only 10 minutes north of Lenox.
There's a big difference between Lenox and Pittsfield.
There is, but it's 10 minutes by car.
Yeah.
It's 10 minutes by car. And people came back. And at the end of that year, we looked at we do a lot of marketing analysis and so forth. And at the end of that year, we had the same number of people from South County that we did 2 years back.
Now, what's wrong with Pittsfield? I mean, it's a city that has had some real problems. You actually live right in the heart of Pittsfield.
I love it.
And I find
it's very safe. I feel very safe.
Right. Nevertheless, every time you open up the Berkshire Eagle, there's something that has happened.
Look, there are sections of Pittsfield, as there are sections in any place that's a city. I think the wonderful thing—
Albany?
I think the wonderful thing about Pittsfield is that it has the most, it's the best ethnic mix, and it's the only place that really in Berkshire County that, I think maybe Lee and North Adams has a little bit, but it has, you know, it has the most heterogeneous population, which I like. And when you have that and you have people coming who are either immigrants or moving to that area, and if there's not employment, there's going to be a problem. The real problem with Pittsfield was that GE left and they took thousands of jobs with them and nothing has been able to replace it. The marvelous thing about Pittsfield is that the arts is leading the economy, because for a while the quality of life in Pittsfield was not good. You know, they were trying to get companies to go to Pittsfield and they'd say, well, let's see, what is there for my family to do? There are no movies. There were no movies at that time. The Beacon Cinema didn't exist. We didn't exist. The Colonial didn't exist. Nobody existed. And so it wasn't a place where you wanted to rear your children. There was the mall. And now there are cinemas, there's Barrington Stage, there's a Colonial, the Berkshire Fringe Festival is moving there, there's a Shakespeare in the Park. There's so much happening in Pittsfield, and it's only a matter of time till people want to live there. They're already wanting to live there, but I think that the market is really, we're going to see a difference, and I think what we're going to really see is we're going to see people in the arts, because the houses are a little cheaper there, and I think people want to go, you know, artists. You know, several people who've worked at Barrington say, I just want to save up enough money to buy a place in Pittsfield. I can afford it. This is the kind of community I want to be in.
Tell us about Mr. Finn.
Bill Finn lives across the street from me in Pittsfield,
as you know.
Mm-hmm. Bill Finn is great. I met Bill Finn. Oh, my God, this is such a funny story. I met Bill Finn. We were doing falsettos, and I didn't know Bill. It was his Tony Award-winning show. And the director comes to me and says, oh, I'm so scared. Bill Finn is renting a house with his partner like 20 minutes from a half hour, and he's dropping into rehearsal. And I think, you know, he's a big guy with a deep voice, a little scary. And so I said, well, great, don't worry. The production's great. He came to rehearsal. And I like to say Bill Finn came to rehearsal and he never left. He loved the production. The director was Rob Ruggiero. He loved the production. And this is a show that he had done many years before. And he came back, saw the show several times 1 week, several times the next week. And in the fall, I called him and said, hey, is there anything that you want to do? And he said, well, I'm working on something. I'll get back to you. And he was working on Spelling Bee. He was working on Spelling Bee. And it was the right call at the right time.
Which became your show.
And he said, I want to do it immediately. Bill has this, I know it's right. And, you know, when writers, particularly musical theater writers, have a show that's ready or they think is ready, they really, really want to jump on it. It takes so long to come up with the idea and to write the songs. And so he said, I want to do it like January, February. And this was in November, maybe early November. I said, well, Bill, like my husband and I are going to Japan, we're going to Japan in January. Like we can't really do that. And he goes, well, I want to do it. And I said, okay, I'm going to work this out. And so we made a deal that he would wait till the second half of January. My artistic associate would sort of, take hold of the project. And before they got into serious rehearsal, I would be back. We raised the money to do a winter workshop. And what happened is, Bill likes to say it was like going into The Shining. It was a winter comparable to this winter. It was tough, cold, blizzards. We brought these nice young folk from the city, Spelling Bee, they're all young actors, who didn't necessarily know how to drive in the snow. They went into snow banks. It was just like amazing. We had a great time. They were there for a month. Rachel Schenken, the book writer, and Bill wrote most of the show in Great Barrington in the apartment that I used to live in right across from Fairview Hospital. They had an apartment right above mine. And they wrote most of the show. We rehearsed it for 3 weeks. We did it for a weekend of performances. No question from the very beginning that it was going to be a hit. They worked on it another week. We did more performances. I love the developmental part of theater. I love taking it, from the first step on. Then we did it in the summer. And to Bill's credit, I said, do you want to do it at Mount Everett and do you want to do it at the Consolati, which is the gigantic auditorium? And he said, no, I want to do it in the second space. I want this to be discovered. I don't want it to be full-blown.
And where was the second space?
In a cafeteria, in the middle school cafeteria. We had turned the two cafeterias into theaters. One was a youth theater and the other cafeteria was our stage two. And he was like, no problem. It's supposed to take place in a school gym. So we're moving it to a cafeteria. What we would do is we would take out the tiling in the ceiling, that kind of fake tiling, and there would be metal bars. We found metal bars there, and we hung our lighting instruments from the metal bars. And we put up the first year we did it, and it was a gigantic cafeteria, and we didn't want all of that. So we took the big black sheets of plastic and made walls.
Interesting.
We then got sophisticated. By the time we did Spelling Bee, we actually had flats up. They were wood, and they was a little better, more sophisticated.
And this went to Broadway, of course.
Went to Broadway from the Mount Everett High School. Junior high school cafeteria.
Do you get any part of that? Does the Barrington stage get any money?
Yeah. Yeah, we do. We get a percentage of it. Much more when it was on Broadway. Now it's not as much, of course, because it's played all over. Now it's, playing in high schools and junior high schools and so forth. But that really helped us in our move. We could not have moved. Well, we could have moved. It would have been more money, but we used that money to move our entire operation to Pittsfield. It was costly. And that really helped us.
So now we'll move from Bill Finn, which was...
By the way, he's doing a show this summer at Barrington with Rachel Schenken. Rachel Schenken wrote the book to Spelling Bee, and he's revisiting a show called Romance in Hard Times that he wrote in the late 1980s. He did the book when he was very young. He didn't know who to go to.
He's a professor, right, at NYU?
Yeah. Yeah, at the musical theater writing program, master's program. So anyhow, so they've been working on this show for several months, and we're going to do it as a workshop. The score is... brilliant. It is a fabulous score.
When you do it as a workshop, explain that to us, because, it may be a little alien to other people besides me.
A workshop it does not open for reviews. In other words, a world premiere, like the show right before that, The Golem of Havana, is a world premiere. We're opening it for reviewers. The workshop is a little lower profile. In other words, the writers just want to work on it.
But is it just a reading, or is it more than that?
Oh, no, it's staged. Uh-huh. So there are three things you can do. A staged reading, which is the first step. He's past that with this work. Yeah. Stage reading, a workshop, or a full production. Uh-huh. A full production gets reviewed by the press. And this is, we want to do, in the Musical Theater Lab, we want to give the writers a chance to hear the work with an audience. So we've done this several times. We did it with the Black Suits, Joe Iconis piece, that workshopped. And, I thought at first we wouldn't have audiences for it because we think that the reviews bring people in. But if it has a high enough profile, you're okay. Or if the music, if you can sell it in some way. With Joe Iconis, he had done several cabarets for us. People knew his music. So it wasn't like bringing somebody new to the Berkshires. In the case of Bill Finn, people know him. And so we're doing it, but we do it for less of a time. We don't run it for 4 or 5 weeks. We're running it for 2.5 weeks. Enough for Rachel and Bill and the cast to get it on its feet, to play it in front of an audience so they can learn about it.
So when will this mature into from a caterpillar to a butterfly?
When it's ready. It could be the next year. It could be longer.
And if it is the next year, you'll put it on as a regular production.
We could. We could put it on as a full production, either on our St. Germain stage or the main stage, or Bill might find another place for it to go. I mean, the main thing we want to do is just give it its first airing and its new life.
Okay, before we move on, what's Mr. Finn's Cabaret?
Mr. Finn's Cabaret is our newest space. We have three spaces. So we have the Boyd Quinson main stage, the 520-seat theater, basically where we do the big musicals. And
which used to be an old theater. I sat there 1 year and got rained on.
Yes,
and it's
before us.
Before you.
Right. Yes. And then we bought a building that used to be the old VFW.
Yeah.
And it's now called the Blatt Center, after Sidon Lee Blatt, who generously, yes, donated the money so we could buy it. And so the first floor is a 114-seat theater called the St. Germain Stage, which is where we do, it's a black box theater. So under it was this great space with a 40-foot pine bar, like unbelievable. Just, and that was the bar for the VFW. I mean, that's where they hung out, you know. And so we have made it into a 99-seat cabaret. We have a stage. We just bought a grand piano, small grand piano. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful. Most of the performances sell out. We had Amanda McBroom there 2 weeks ago, totally sold out. But not only do we bring performers like Amanda McBroom, KT Sullivan, Bill also brings some of the young musical theater writers that he knows from NYU, and they do evenings of work. It's a chance for them. They're not ready to do maybe a full musical, you know, on the stage too, whether it's a workshop or a full production. But they have a number of songs, and they're funny and they're witty. So we do cabarets with them. And it's just a wonderful opportunity for us to use for every level of musical theater performer.
So I want to talk to you next about your other secret weapon, who was on your board from day one. I didn't know that until you told us. Mark St. Germain, this incredible author, and who has just been doing magnificent work for you. And how did that all come about? How did you meet him in the first place?
I have known Mark since 1980. I've known him long time.
You sound like that's a long time ago. To a 73-year-old, it doesn't seem that
okay.
long ago.
Okay, well, that's to me. I mean, we were but children. Mark wasn't married yet, and I think he now has a son who's like 28 or 29 or something. So anyhow.
Is that possible?
Yeah. Yeah. So I interviewed Mark to write a book for a musical that I was working on based on the Just So stories, and he got the job. And we've become friends ever since then. And he said, oh, I have these plays. And two plays he had, there were two one-acts, The Collier Brothers at Home and Period Piece. I actually directed and produced I Like Him So Much, like off Broadway. And then when I was at Berkshire Theater Festival, we did Camping with Henry and Tom about Henry Ford and Thomas Edison.
Now, you forgot to tell us about the Berkshire Theater Festival. A little interlude here, folks, and that is the other great drama entity is the Berkshire Theater Festival, which is now combined with the Colonial Theater and is now under the great Kate McGuire, and this is now known as the Berkshire Theater Group.
Right.
And you were directing there for a while. Right?
I was there for 2 years.
Yes.
And the wonderful thing was that because I had known Mark for so long,
yeah.
I asked him to come up and he said, I have this new play. So Mark and our paths just kept on crossing. So we did that. So we were starting a new theater. I always feel that on the board you need artists, because it's one thing for business people
sure.
to be on the board. And that's important because we can't run the theater
without
them.
But then you need people to educate them.
Well, yes, we need people to say what I need and what, you know, so forth. So Mark has done several shows. But lately, I'd say within the last, in 2009, he did Freud's Last Session. You know, which is a conversation between Sigmund Freud and C.S. Lewis. And I booked it in my wisdom, Alan, for 2 weeks, thinking, will want to listen? It's a wonderful Marvel.
Well, every psychoanalyst in the world, if they're not on Martha's Vineyard or in the Berkshires.
You're right. They all live in the Berkshires. Anyhow, so we were running it for 2 weeks, and it was selling out.
It kept going.
It's
like our giving away some kind of a thing, like our giving away a crank radio. And they go in a minute, and then we say, okay, they just had babies, we have more. And so Freud kept going.
We ran it 8 weeks the first summer, and then someone wanted to take it into New York, and they said, would you run it 2 weeks the following summer? You can build the set and get it ready to go into New York. So we did it, and it's been playing it ran in New York for 2 years. It's all over the country now.
Do you get money for that, too?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, not a lot. It sounds like
I'm only asking you questions which I think occur to other people.
I think it's important because if we take the chance.
Sure.
If we go out on the high dive and we do this work, you know, this two-character play about Sigmund Freud and C.S. Lewis.
A play that never happened, by the way.
That's right.
Those people never really did have this conversation, but it was a wonderful play. I loved it.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful conceit. And so he did Becoming Dr. Ruth, of course, based on Dr. Ruth Westheimer. this year.
And that's gone to Broadway also, right?
That's off-Broadway.
Off-Broadway.
That was off-Broadway.
Yeah.
It was great. And so this year we're doing Dancing Lessons, his new play, on the main stage. The other play that we did of his on the main stage was The Best of Enemies.
Uh-huh.
Did you see that one?
Yes.
Ann Atwater and C.P. Ellis. It was just an amazing, amazing play. And that one was so successful in the summer that we brought it back for the school kids in the fall because it dealt with desegregation of schools in North Carolina. So this year we're doing one, and the main character has Asperger's. Unbelievable play. And he's very wise and very bright and very funny and says things inappropriately, as you can well imagine. But it's a true picture of someone with high-end Asperger's. He teaches in a technical college in New York. And he is befriended by a dancer. He wants the dancing lesson because he has to dance at a public function where he's being honored. And he is befriended by an injured dancer. And so the question is, who's really handicapped? You know, and it's about their relationship. Funny, charming. And so we're doing it on the main stage in our third slot. And the other thing we're doing this year, you know, until you do a play about something about autism and Asperger's, you're not aware of really what's happening. We're doing two sensory-friendly shows, meaning two shows for people who have autism. We're doing one matinee solely for them and their families, one on Dancing Lessons, and then we're doing Hairspray Junior, sort of the youth theater version, and we're doing a performance of that, too. People can check on the website.
Are you killing yourself doing all of this?
Love it.
Yeah.
No. You know what? It's great because we're doing for the community.
I mean, personally killing yourself, your energy level is just incredible.
It gives me more energy.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, okay, what did I learn since I've been in Pittsfield? What I've learned about it is that I thought when I came to Pittsfield that I would be doing theaters, I would be doing less serious theater. Because people said to me, oh, Pittsfield's a blue-collar town. Where are the people who are going to come to see the work? It's the exact opposite. Because it's the center, because it's Berkshire Medical Center, and where there's a medical center, there are lawyers, and there are shrinks, and there's everyone else. It is such a fabulous professional community. We've never done more serious theater. We've just opened Char White's The Other Place with Marg Helgenberger. And it's unbelievable. I mean, it sold out immediately. When we did The Whipping Man, which is about an African-American man who was Jewish at the time of the Civil War, it sold out immediately. And I think there is a serious audience. People they want good drama. They want it to be good theater. But along with serious theater, you deal with social issues. There are a lot of social issues. Last year, we did a musical about transgendering. We did another play about the digital age. People stay and they talk about these things. And that's what gives me the energy, knowing that I'm affecting the people. I think we're theater for the community. We're not community theater. We want to get to the people and affect their minds and their thinking. We want them to come back because they know they may not love the play, but they're going to be able to talk about it afterwards, and it will be well done.
Let's go back to Marc St. Germain for a moment. You know, to some degree, I'm thinking that his loyalty to you is like a loyalty in a marriage. You know, he could go other places, but he stays with you. What's that about?
I think, our personalities match, obviously. Mm-hmm. I mean, you would have to do that.
I love this guy, by the way. I really do.
He's great. Yeah. He's like a big teddy bear, a very bright big teddy bear.
He's also a very nice man.
He's a great guy. He's a great guy. I think that he loves the way we do his work. I mean, I'll go to the mat to get the right actor for him, and we get the right designers.
Does he get a consult? In other words, when you say, I'll go to the mat to get an actor for him, does he ever say, no, that won't do?
Oh, sure. We always cast together. Oh, totally.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, yeah. I would never cast it. If there's a live playwright, I would never cast a show without that playwright.
So tell me how that works. I mean, take us to the room when you're doing the casting.
Okay, so we're casting in New York. Pat McCorkle is our casting director for 14 years now. And I spend most of March and April in New York casting shows.
And Pat is a lady or a man?
Pat is a woman,
okay.
Patricia McCorkle. So anyhow, and then we're in there. And generally what we do is, if the playwright is not alive, like if we're doing Kiss Me, Kate. I mean, Kiss Me, Kate took a month to cast. We don't do it like that. I mean, it takes us a while because sometimes the director, until he or she sees the people come in, the actors, doesn't know what he or she wants for that role. Oftentimes they know
That's
right away.
Yeah.
Right. Oftentimes they know right away, but sometimes they don't. And so I think that's important. In the case of Dancing Lessons, we were hiring this dancer. We weren't sure what we were looking for. We started working on this play more than a year ago. We did a reading of it last September before the summer season was over on the main stage. It was very, very successful. People loved it. And so Marc was saying, I think I'm looking for another quality in the dancer. And so we've been sort of massaging what he's looking for. And it's important for the playwright to be in the room. So if we disagree, we generally say, let's have the person read another scene. They'll come in again. Let's see them another time and give them more material from the play to read. Maybe that'll make it clearer.
Well, do they always just come back? Do they ever say, no, this is too much. I don't want to do it another time.
Occasionally, they don't tell you that. They just go, they're busy. You know, yeah. Pat'll say, oh, this person's got a job. Or they're never going to be like, you know, I don't want to do this or something. And I'm sure that in some instances it does. As the theater gets better known, you know, like, I'll tell you what really helped us, On the Town. You know, the musical On the Town last year was a big, big hit, and it's moving into New York. It's moving to Broadway in September. It's going to open October.
Mm-hmm.
Just unbelievable. And just all of that publicity from that, often agents take note, actors take note, say, I want to work in that theater. They have shows that move. They have shows that are exciting, mm-hmm. directed by John Rando and Josh Bergas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the three sailors who started that production are moving with it. So, you know, the casting was really strong. The casting was strong. They're actually moving with the show. And
don't they often want to get a name?
These guys are so fabulous.
They're just so good that it doesn't really matter if you got some major actor who says, I'll take some time off from movies to do this.
The difficulty in casting On the Town was when it was originally done in the movie and actually when it was done in New York before, they would have three funny actors do the sailor scenes.
Yeah.
They would have one guy who did Gabby, who did the Gene Kelly role. He could dance, and they would bring in dancers for the other two guys because they were comedians. Well, out of budgetary concerns, we had to cast the same three guys. They had to be able to sing, dance, and act. And that's the brilliance of the production, I think, is these guys can do everything. You can't find many guys who can do everything.
Julie, have you ever gotten into a fight with an actor?
Have I gotten into a fight with an actor? I love actors.
I know. That's not the question.
Disagreements.
That wasn't the question.
I don't think a fight.
Have you ever had anybody throw anything at you?
No.
Okay.
No.
No, but anybody who's called you the B word or anything like that.
Not to my face.
Oh, okay.
You know, no, because I think healthy arguments are good in rehearsal. Because, you know, I'm working on a script all by myself for months, and all of a sudden, we have these three-dimensional figures there called actors with brilliant minds, and they go, how about this? And sometimes you go, well, no, I see it this way. And they'll say, will you think about this? And I generally say, let me think about it. Because they're bringing something to it that I haven't.
But I did ask you a question, and I don't remember the answer coming forth.
I have never been in
Has there ever really been a serious fight with an actor? In which they say, if you don't do it my way, I'm out the door.
No, they wouldn't do that.
Has there ever been a time you said, you're out the door?
No.
Hey, wait a second. You've never fired anybody?
An actor
that's
worked on a show of mine?
Yes.
I don't think I have.
Okay.
I mean, I just love actors. And we have a great time together. It's laughing. We're a family. I'm not saying that I don't disagree with a point. If an actor wants to do something or a certain take, I'll say, no, I don't want that. And they'll say yes. I'll say no. And then I think I haven't made myself clear enough. If the actor won't do what I want, then perhaps I haven't said it clearly enough.
But what about, Julie, if they can't do what you want?
Then you change. Then you say, they can't do that. Okay, let me see. New attack. My job is to be flexible. Okay, let's try this and see if this works.
What if they can't memorize their lines?
Oh, only once has that happened in all of the years that I've been directing, which is many, many years. And that person, he was an older fellow, and he himself said, I can't learn. I have to drop out. That's heartbreaking.
I'll bet it is.
Heartbreaking.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about, you were talking about the troubles of Pittsfield, you know, that it's emerging. There was a wonderful mayor named Jimmy Roberto. He was extremely wonderful about the arts, bringing the arts in to Pittsfield. And I think it's fair to say now, after he's gone, that there is still, you know, a sense that the arts are important to Pittsfield.
Mm-hmm.
So was that a factor in your success?
Oh, definitely. Jimmy Roberto was one of our biggest champions. He was fabulous. I mean, he's one of the reasons that we moved there, and he helped tremendously for us to get, you know, there's a GE fund, and we were able to get $500,000 to help us because our campaign was $7 million, raising that money in Pittsfield at a time when it wasn't there. I mean, it still isn't, and the Colonial was also raising money. It was like a very difficult time. Berkshire Museum was doing something. We're all raising money. Jimmy Roberto is just so, he's so alive, and he loves the arts so much, and he loves Pittsfield. It was tremendously exciting working with him, and he's still a good friend.
So how much time, Julianne Boyd, do you have to spend talking to the politicians, the city council people, the others? How do you court them? How do you get them to be on your side?
Well, I think the main thing is to get them to go to the theater and see the work we do.
Mm-hmm.
I think action speaks louder than words. You can talk all you want, but they have to come to the theater. They have to see what we're doing, and hopefully they love what we're doing.
Is there anybody in the city, a politician, without naming names, obviously, who you feel You know, basically, there's been some talk about let's do more for the neighborhoods and less for the downtown people.
Do you know, I think that takes care of itself. You're not going to believe this. I don't take it 100% seriously when they do that, because if you don't have a successful downtown Pittsfield, the neighborhoods aren't going to bring the people there.
But you know politicians. You know politicians.
Yeah, I know. They say what they want to say, and they want a slightly different plan of action than the person before them, because they can't run on the same platform. I think that it's important, as far as we're concerned, is to be involved in the community. Now, my managing director, Tristan Wilson, is very, very involved. So is our marketing director, Laura Radebush, and various committees in the city. Tristan's on the parking commission because parking is a problem now. Mm-hmm. Who thought that Pittsfield was going to have a problem with all of its parking spaces?
Isn't that big parking lot right across the street there? There's a huge parking lot. We've never had a problem.
Because there's so many. In the evening, there's no problem, but during the day, there are permit parking.
Yeah. Okay, but I want to ask you something with which no Julie Boyd conversation would be complete.
I can't wait to hear this, Alan.
Well, you know, you and I have had many talks about theater criticism. And
she's trying to bang her head against the table, I should say.
I have spent many, many columns dealing with your stuff. And when a particularly unkind thing that receives every accolade from the New York Times and the Boston Globe, but one guy says, I don't like it. And almost predictably, this has got to be very frustrating.
It's very difficult, and it is frustrating. I mean, I can't say that it isn't, because I would be lying. It's difficult, but what we're trying to do with the theater, you know, I think criticism is changing. I think people aren't reading newspapers as much. They're going to blogs or tweeting, and they're Facebooking and all this other stuff. And I think the world is changing. I think the world of criticism is changing. And in some ways, that's not good, because people aren't going to one source. We'd like them to read more. But in other ways, it's very good, and it may be very good for us.
Sure. The Herald Tribune, I remember, they used to have two critics. The New York Times had two critics.
Yes.
Just in case one guy was a jerk, the other guy, you know, sort of mopped up.
Do you remember Walter Kerr used to write Sunday reviews?
Sure.
And whoever wrote, you know, the daily reviews.
Sure.
So what we're really trying to do, and we have spent a lot of time, and it is working, and that's pre-selling our season.
Well, that's a great idea.
It's almost...
So they can't do damage.
Right. And listen, if you get a great review, I can't tell you the difference that it makes. When we got that rave review from Ben Brantley and On the Town,
he
said, you know, the production was worth taking a three-hour drive to see.
I remember that.
Our box office, I can't tell you what happened.
And you're always very kind to me when I do positive columns about... on my Saturday column in the Eagle, and saying that the phones do ring in response to a good article.
They do. If you get a good review in a paper, it's worth a really rave review for us in a local paper somewhere. It's worth $10,000 to $20,000, local paper. If you get a bad review, the opposite. When we got the New York Times review, our box office like tripled for a couple of days. Wall Street Journal can do that too, because a lot of people are still, the people in the Berkshires read not only the local papers, but they read the other papers as well.
But I, Publius, in the Berkshire Eagle can't do that?
Yeah, it doesn't do what?
Ben Brantley did.
Sorry, Alan.
Well,
sorry about
then
that.
You don't get any more.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so.
But what I want to say, what we're doing is we're selling many more subscriptions at a time in this business where people said subscriptions are going downhill. Our subscriptions, like last year to this year, we've already made our subscription goal, and we haven't even opened this season. We're 25% ahead of last year.
Now, let's talk about this season. What do you got?
Okay. So, you know, we already opened our stage two at the other place, a Char White play starring Marg, and that plays through June 14th.
So everybody knows, the other place is not slang. It's the name of the theater.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, that's right. That would be funny. Don't go to the other place. Anyhow, plays through June 14th. But our really big musical this year is the first time we've done Cole Porter. It's Kiss Me, Kate. I'm so excited. I'm so excited about doing Kiss Me, Kate. Kiss Me, Kate runs June 11th through July 12th. And the young woman, Elizabeth Stanley, who was one of the three women on the town, gorgeous, gorgeous soprano voice, gorgeous woman, is playing the lead. And a man named Paul Anthony Stewart, also just fabulous, is doing the male lead.
Is that great when somebody comes back, an alumnus comes back and knows the deal?
It's fabulous.
Yeah.
Because you know what they do? They lead the cast. They lead the cast. And they go, oh, you want to go to Dottie's for coffee? And you want to go here for lunch and go here?
And they become the captain, like Derek Jeter.
Yeah, they really do. And then we're doing something very, very different called Breaking the Code in the second slot on the main stage, which runs July 17th to August 2nd.
And what's that about?
It's about Alan Turing, the man, the British man who broke the German Enigma Code.
Imagine. I'd love to see that.
It's a brilliant, brilliant play by Hugh Whitemore. Derek Jacobi played it on Broadway. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's fascinating. I just recently went to Bletchley Park.
Really?
In outside of London. Oh, anyone who can go there should go there. It's just,
anybody who's ever watched the History Channel will have to go there.
Yes. And also, what is it called? Bletchley Circle, about the women who are code breakers, too? It's a really exciting play. The third one is Mark St. Germain's Dancing Lessons, which runs August 7th to the 24th. Then in the fall, talk about our involvement with the community. Mm. We're doing Arthur Miller's adaptation of a play called An Enemy of the People, a play that was originally written by Henrik Ibsen.
Oh, I know it very well.
And it's about a town where the waters are polluted. Mm-hmm. There are two brothers, one's the mayor and one's the doctor, who finds the pollution. And it is so appropriate for the Berkshires. You know, I read this play this year and I said, why didn't I do this play before? You know, well, why did I miss this before? And so we're doing a lot with environmental group, and a lot of the high schools have already signed up. So I think that's really important. So we go through like the third week in October. So we start in May, mid-May, and we go through October, third week of October, which is why we're no longer in Mount Everett High School, bringing it full circle around, because we now can do all of this. On our stage two, should I quickly say what's in our stage two? Our stage two, the second show, which starts June 18th, is called Working on a Special Day. And it's based on an Italian film called A Special Day that Marcello Mastroianni and Sophia Loren did about 1938, Hitler's moving into Rome to meet Mussolini coming in. And it's about a harried housewife who's home and a man who lives across the way, sort of an unhappy bachelor in their relationship during this time. It's a beautiful, beautiful play. And we're doing that second.
Sounds
and that's
great.
That's our first international theater company we're bringing in. It's a Mexican theater company who did this. Third is
they're doing this play in Spanish?
No. Actually, they have slight Italian accents. They, you know, Spanish, they speak Italian, too.
It was my attempt at a bad joke. Go ahead, Julie.
Ha ha. Okay, the third one is part of the Musical Theater Lab. It's the world premiere of The Golem of Havana, and that's the lab, as I said. And it's basically about a Hungarian Jewish family that live in Havana in 1958, 1959, at the time that Batista is losing power and Castro is about to take over. It's about a teenage daughter of this older Hungarian Jewish couple, and who've gone through everything, have gone through the camps. They finally came to Cuba, trying to get into the U.S.
Which is where they could get to, yeah.
Yes, and she develops a relationship with a Castro revolutionary, the daughter does, and how the parents feel about another gigantic upheaval in their lives. Music is fascinating. It is part klezmer, part Latino. Two Latino Jews from Venezuela
Sounds
wrote it.
Great.
It's fabulous. And then last one is Romance in Hard Times, Bill Finn show. The Golem runs July 16th to August 10th, and Romance in Hard Times is August 14th through the 31st.
Well, Julie Boyd, I guess there's only one question real quickly. My number one question, I'm getting to be a little older now, and you were standing there the other night when we had a little reception.
I know what you're going
to
ask.
Somebody has said to me, what happens after you basically, parentheses, die, Alan?
That was really weirdly asked, Alan. Very weirdly asked,
well,
yes.
Well, nice person,
yes.
But I think very concerned. And then we had a board member answer who said, we'll find somebody else. So what happens when you decide it's enough?
Do you know, the board at Barrington Stage has been, we've been talking about this, isn't
sure.
anything, and I'm sure you've been doing the same
sure.
thing. We talk about legacy, and right now we have a fabulous staff. I mean, the staff that really knows every inch of the theater and every department. And I'm not looking at it, but I'm not planning as you are
well,
in the
we
next
don't
couple
have a,
of years.
We don't
I mean,
have
I feel
a
very healthy.
We don't have a Julie
and,
Boyd. You don't have a Julie Boyd waiting in the wings.
No. No, I wish I did, but I don't.
I mean, you are a unique
But I don't want
individual.
One. I wish I did in 3 years or 5 years. You know, I don't need one now because we couldn't afford another me.
I don't know that they're out there. Julie, I'll be honest with you. I don't know that they are out there. I've seen it happen. I've seen places like Williamstown go through one after another, you know, and try to find the right person who will do it. It is, I think, a very serious problem when you have an incredible personality and ability like yours. The only thing that I've been missing in your career is, you know, you have a PhD in Japanese theater, and I'd like to see something kabuki or something.
Kabuki.
Yeah, kabuki.
I did a play about Japanese war brides many years ago, which I love doing.
Well, Julie Boyd, we love you. We've been talking with Julie Ann Boyd, co-founder of the Barrington Stage Company, and it's just a terrific opportunity to talk to you once again, Julianne. Thanks for everything you've done for the city of Pittsfield, for all of us, for the great theater, and thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Alan. Thanks for having me.
You
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Shartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.